From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And as the nation celebrates Veterans Day today, a new phase of the impeachment inquiry is about to kick off in Washington. Democrats will call several witnesses this week who have already testified behind closed doors. And meanwhile, Nikki Haley, President Trump's former ambassador to the United Nations, released her memoir today and spoke with NPR, saying the president's actions with regard to Ukraine are not a good practice, but not impeachable.
Yes, he asked for the investigation that never happened. And was there aid involved? Yes. And it flowed regardless. And so did he put down the hammer and insist on this? No, he didn't. And so for that, you know, impeachment's a serious issue, and I don't see it as impeachable.
More of that interview today on All Things Considered. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us now. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you.
So House Democrats hope that these hearings this week, these public hearings, which many NPR stations will be carrying live, will break through to the public. Who will we be hearing from?
Former Ambassador William Taylor, who has been ambassador to Ukraine and then was brought back in to be the senior State Department official after the president caused to be removed the most recent ambassador there, Yovanovitch, and we're going to be hearing eventually from her as well. William Taylor is a West Point graduate and a decorated war hero in the United States military and someone whose reputation in the State Department is truly beyond reproach. He is someone whose reaction to what happened here with the president's pressure on the Ukrainian president has been key to the depositions we have seen thus far from the closed-door hearings. So they're bringing him out as, if you will, the lead witness, the star witness, right at the very beginning to make the strongest, perhaps, part of the case right off the bat.
Now, Republicans have asked to call different witnesses, including Hunter Biden and others. Democrats control the process, though. Anybody from the GOP's list that might actually get to testify publicly?
It's possible. We don't want to get out in front of the Democratic chairs in deciding this. And I imagine that the Democratic leadership, including Nancy Pelosi, will also have some thoughts on this. But Hunter Biden, it would seem to me, would not be someone that they thought was relevant to what President Trump was trying to do here, even if what was motivating President Trump was something to do with the Bidens. I think they want to keep the focus on the president's behavior here and let the president's own investigations turn up whatever they may be able to down the road about the Bidens.
Okay, let me ask you about something else, which is Nikki Haley's new memoir. You have read all of it. Haley was the first non-white and female governor of South Carolina. She was reticent about President Trump back in 2016 before he was president, but then surprised many by going to work for him as ambassador to the UN. How does she portray the Trump administration in this memoir?
She portrays the White House and the Trump administration as largely a mess, uses all kinds of critical terms about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who clearly regarded Nikki Haley as a subordinate. Nikki Haley saw herself as an equal. Nikki Haley tells us in the book that she was sounded out to be Secretary of State right from the very beginning, but didn't think that that was the right role for her. So clearly implies, at least, that she was the first choice before Rex Tillerson. She also doesn't have any use for former Chief of Staff John Kelly. She says that John Kelly and Rex Tillerson took her aside at one point outside the Oval Office and suggested that she should join them in restraining the president, saying that the president needed to be handled. He had to be corralled by sensible people. And she was apparently shocked by this, and she was apparently horrified at the thought that somebody would be undermining the Constitution by substituting their own judgment for that of the president, even if those other people were the president's choice to be his chief of staff and secretary of state. So she didn't want any part of that. And not too long after Tillerson had left as secretary of state, she also tendered her resignation, not in an angry way and not in a rebellious way. A lot of people wondered why she was leaving. It's clear from this book that she is still friendly towards the president, still wants to praise the president as apart from his administration, and particularly wants to remain close to the president's voter base.
For 2024 or even sooner than that, Maggie Haberman of The New York Times tweeted out, this isn't going to tamp down the speculation that the president is considering putting Nikki Haley on the ticket and replacing Pence.
You know, there are two kinds of books coming up. right now. We're getting a lot of books about the Trump administration from former officials in that administration, a lot of books about the biography, the campaign biography of people who'd like to be president. I think this book qualifies as both. It's clearly a promotion for her future political life. She says she doesn't have any other doors that she's knocking on at this point, but, you know, if one should open for her, actually the way she puts it is, if God should open one for her, well, she'll see what's on the other side. She does not take on Vice President Pence, speaks of him only very respectfully. She does not say anything about replacing him, but she also doesn't say anything to scoff at that speculation, while she does quite explicitly rule out any kind of a challenge to President Trump himself in 2020. So that's going to leave open both the vice presidential speculation and certainly do nothing to damp down the speculation about her ambitions in 2024.
Interesting. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeremy.
In New Hampshire, a new voter residency law has led to confusion, charges of voter suppression, and a legal challenge. Supporters of the law say it is supposed to clarify the state's voting rules. But as Anthony Brooks of WBUR reports, opponents believe it's a blatant effort by Republicans to block college students who come from out of state from voting.
That's a serious charge as an election year approaches. The complaints are coming from Democrats, including Elizabeth Warren, as she campaigns for the first-in-the-nation presidential primary.
I want to say something that I know is very controversial in some places in New Hampshire. I believe in the right of every American citizen to vote, including college students.
That's Warren at the University of New Hampshire recently. She's referring to House Bill 1264, which Republican Governor Chris Sununu signed last year. Essentially, the law changes the definition of a legal resident in New Hampshire and adds new requirements to vote. It means if a student drives, they'll need to get a New Hampshire license and register their car here. It used to be that students or other part-time residents could vote here if they were domiciled in the state, which is a fancy way of saying lived here more than anywhere else. But Tyler Pierce and Greta Swartz, who are from New Hampshire and attend UNH, worry that the new law makes it harder for out-of-state students to vote.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a concern because when you have, like, any sort of voter suppression, which I think that this is really, like, we're not giving people their votes where they're being counted.
It's important. I mean, if you go to school in New Hampshire, I think that you represent the state as much as anybody else that lives here. It's your home now. So I think it's important for people to be able to vote where they are.
Maggie Flaherty, a junior at Dartmouth College who comes from California, agrees with that. She's a plaintiff in a case filed by the ACLU, challenging the law as an effort to suppress the student vote. The ACLU says linking voting rights to residency requirements, like paying to register a car or getting a state license, amounts to an unconstitutional poll tax. Maggie Flaherty just calls the law confusing, something that local election officials complain about as well.
Students don't know if they can vote or how to vote. And so the fact that this bill has made voting confusing and difficult and hard is a barrier in and of itself.
But Barbara Griffin, a Republican state representative, supports the law. She says New Hampshire was the only state in the country that didn't require voters to be legal residents, and that led to confusion.
New Hampshire has a pretty high seasonal population. And we have people who in the past have contacted our Secretary of State's office and said, I heard you don't need to live in New Hampshire to vote there. How do I vote?
Griffin says the new law takes care of that and makes it clear that only legal residents can vote. She says that's especially important in New Hampshire.
Given our status as a swing state and that we have had historically some of the closest elections in the country, we had a Senate race, I believe, decided by 2 votes. We think it's important to make sure that everybody's vote is counted the same and is counted correctly.
By the way, she's right about that Senate race. In 1975, John Durkin beat Lewis Wyman by just 2 votes in the closest U.S. Senate election ever. More recently, in 2016, Senator Maggie Hassan, the Democratic incumbent, beat Republican Kelly Ayotte by just over 1,000 votes. While Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in New Hampshire by fewer than 3,000. So thousands of out-of-state college students who lean Democratic can sway a close election. And that has long chafed New Hampshire Republicans. After 2016, one Republican lawmaker said, if you're in New Hampshire just 8 months a year, you shouldn't be able to vote here. The law passed mostly along party lines and remains the source of a bitter partisan fight.
There was a time in our country where we used to have poll taxes.
Rennie Cushing is a Democratic state rep from New Hampshire and a state co-chair of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. He says the new law is a setback for voting rights.
And finally, the United States Supreme Court decided that such a fundamental right as the right to vote should not be conditioned upon someone's economic wealth or any other reasons. And that's what this attack on the franchise is doing.
Supporters point out that the New Hampshire Supreme Court reviewed and approved the measure before Governor Sununu signed it. But now it's being challenged not only by the ACLU, but also by the New Hampshire Democratic Party. Opponents say with a general election just a year away, there's a lot at stake in this case. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It's Here and Now.
How you get so much favor on your side? Accept the measure, Lord and Savior, I replied. That's your love, that neighbor, not divide. I'm a ride, that's on God.
That's the track On God from Kanye West's latest album, Jesus is King. It's his first gospel album, which debuted last month, and it's already making history. Kanye is the first artist to hold all 10 spots on both Billboard's Hot Christian Songs and Hot Gospel Songs. This week, the album also topped other Billboard charts, including Top Rap Album. But Kanye isn't the only hip-hop artist to cross over into the gospel world. MC Hammer did it in 1990. And just last year, Snoop Dogg did the same.
Once upon a time in the Church of God, there were sinners and saints. Evens to odds, do's and don'ts, wills and won'ts. The haves to the have-nots will be sitting up front, getting a sermon amongst women.
So, if Kanye is not the first to cross over into the gospel genre, how and why has this new album had such profound reach? Music and cultural writer Naima Cochran has been writing about this. She's also a former music executive, and she joins us now. Naima, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Kanye West has been a polarizing figure for quite some time now. A big part of that is because of his support of President Donald Trump, which confounds so many. But this album, Jesus is King, as you write, was expected to offer a formal presentation of his new spiritual growth. Do you think it's been that for people?
I think it's been that for the people who want that. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Those who are skeptical of Kanye's new birth and the actual depth of it did not find much to convince them otherwise in Jesus is King. But those who were looking to believe Kanye do point to it as evidence of him having this new, like, spiritual rebirth. But to me, it is a little superficial, as a lot of things with Kanye are. Things that Kanye believes to be kind of world-changing and radical are very surface because he doesn't really have a lot of depth often in his concepts and in his points of view. The same way with Trump. He just likes Trump's energy. And I think it's the same thing with him being, like, newly saved. But he feels like he is in a space to kind of preach to others when he himself is still working on it.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, about the album Jesus is King. You say shallow, a little superficial. What's missing from it?
The thing about gospel is that gospel isn't just about lyricism. It's about a musical translation of scripture and scriptural themes to music. But then there's praise and worship, which is, it's like gospel light. Mm-hmm. It's repetitive. It maybe touches on a phrase of inspiration, but it doesn't necessarily go deep into a message of salvation or a message of Christ. And mm-hmm. what Kanye is doing with Jesus is King is kind of praise and worship rap. It's not really deep gospel rap.
You write that historically we've seen the use of religion as a way to come back to center, part of a redemption playbook. Can you explain what you mean by that?
In the Black community, when we have notable figures who have done something to offend or have done something that finds them in a disgraceful position in the mainstream, usually part of their redemption story is to reach back out to the Black community through the grace of the church, because the Black church is known to be unfailingly forgiving, especially to our Black men. Even as fewer millennials are growing up in the Black church, the ideology of the Black church is still the centerpiece of the Black community. So some people do it genuinely. When Al Green's career started to falter, he came back to the church because he's from the church. But when Michael Jackson, who didn't even grow up traditionally in the Black church, was about to go on trial, he came to the Black church. When O.J. Simpson, who famously was very much like, I'm not Black, I'm O.J., was acquitted, but then his people in L.A., in the communities, in the gated communities, really weren't rocking with him anymore, he came back. So at a glance, it looks like this is what Kanye's doing, but he's not. He's actually co-opting the Black church experience for non-Black consumption. He's doing this for his mainstream fans. He's not doing this for us, because he's actually doubling down on the things that pissed us off, even while he's packaging this all up in like a Black church presentation.
I listened to Kanye's album, and what really moves me the most are the actual singers and the choir, not necessarily Kanye. Here's the Sunday service choir with a little bit of the track Every Hour. Naima, what do gospel artists, what have they said or their take on Kanye's gospel?
Producer Warren Campbell, who is married to gospel artist Erica Campbell, who is half of Mary Mary, has said that he was someone that Kanye has come to when he's wanted like some guidance and some help with scripture. Some preachers and pastors have co-signed under the argument that anything that brings the message of God into a space where people don't normally hear it is a good thing.
I mean, that's a valid argument, though.
It is. But I'm of the mind that the messenger matters. That really is kind of a debate that's happening right now, is like, do we really condemn Kanye when, even if the execution isn't right, there could be people who are brought to God through what he's doing? But what bothers me, outside of the album itself, the Sunday service is another thing altogether.
And those Sunday services you're talking about are those like mini type concerts that Kanye West is having throughout the country.
Right. It's kind of like a modern day traveling tent revival, almost, if you would. Mm-hmm. The thing about those that troubles me is that Kanye is still at these Sunday services saying really problematic things about slavery being a choice, or if slave masters are going to throw the nets again, let's not stand in the same place, or about being a free thinker and not making decisions based on skin color, wearing MAGA hats, or abolishing the 13th Amendment, which, what even are you talking about? So I think that's great that there's songs of praise going on and they feel like maybe Kanye's intentions are good, but still mixed up in that is the same messaging that's troubling from the outset.
Yeah. Broadening this out a little bit, Kanye West may be the most notable artist to do this in recent history, as we talked about. But there are questions of whether artists like Justin Bieber, for instance, who sang a religious song at Coachella recently, he might be releasing a religious album. There's been lots of talk about that. Do you think we're seeing a shift here, or have we seen this before?
I don't think it's really new. I think that people may be paying attention to it differently just because of the era of consumption that we're in. But there has always been a tendency for artists to, maybe not in hip hop, but in pop and R&B, artists who came up with some kind of a spiritual background have always thrown maybe at least one good inspirational song on the album or maybe done a collaboration. It used to actually be a thing for R&B artists in the 90s. Like, there was always, like, one track. A friend of mine called it tithing on your album. Like, one-tenth of your album had to go to something about God. And we kind of got away from that. But I do think a certain demo will be inclined to want to point to Kanye and say he did this just because they don't remember a time when it wasn't uncommon.
Yeah, but thinking about musical trends, I mean, as you said, there was always one song. And I actually spoke recently with the co-writer of this new Prince memoir. And one thing that Prince said more or less is that it's hard to make religious music a mainstream hit. He would have one or two on his album. But this in particular, Kanye's album, what impact do you think this album will have on the future of secular music and gospel?
Well, it's hard to say because more of this is about it being Kanye than about it being the subject material. But, you know, if random rapper ABC were to do this same thing, it wouldn't necessarily have the same impact. And it doesn't mean that a label is going to be willing to take a chance on the next artist who says, I want to do a gospel album because Kanye did it. You can't remove the Kanye factor from it. Or with Bieber, you can't remove the fact that he's Justin Bieber from it. I would like to see it make more artists comfortable in exploring this avenue, but I don't think, and I could very well be wrong, I don't think that Jesus is King itself is going to signal like some seismic shift in the genre going towards a more spiritual direction.
That's Naima Cochran, a music and cultural writer and former music executive. Naima, thanks for this conversation.
Thank you again for having me. Glad to be part of it.
God is King, we the soldiers. Ultra beam out the solar. When I get to heaven's gate, I ain't gotta peek over. Keeping perfect composure. When I scream at the chauffeur, I'm just focused. Put a lean out slower. Got us clean out of soda. Before the flood, people judge. They did the same thing to Noah. Everybody wanted Yandy. That Jesus Christ did the laundry. They say that we start on Monday, but the strong start on Sunday. Won't be in bondage to any man. John 8:33. We the descendants of Abraham.
And we want to know what you think about Jesus is King and Kanye's new musical direction. Tell us your thoughts at hereandnow.org. Black Friday and Cyber Monday are creeping up on us in just a few weeks. But in China, Monday was Singles Day. It was first celebrated as an alternative to Valentine's Day, but now it's the world's busiest online shopping day. For more on the economic importance of this day, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So I'm hearing that retailers took in $60 billion on Singles Day, with half of that going to Alibaba, China's biggest online commerce company. What were folks buying?
This is amazing. Consumers pounced on discounts on everything from smartphones, but also craft beer and healthcare packages. Electronics seller Sun Ning, which is one of the rivals that participated in this, said sales of their smartphones and other electronics passed $160 million. You ready for this? In the first minute after midnight. Oh, my gosh. Dang Dang, it's an online book retailer in China, said it sold 6.8 million books, 6.8 million copies of books in 1 hour. So this is intense.
That is intense. To give people perspective, here in the United States, retailers took in $6.2 billion. So that China's is basically 10 times bigger than our biggest day. But for months, it feels like we've been hearing how Chinese consumers are saving instead of spending because of the trade war. iPhone sales slumped and those types of things. But how badly are
Chinese consumers hurting, really, if they're spending $60 billion on Singles Day?
Well, I mean, I think we have to really think of this as a unique thing. It's like Black Friday and Cyber Monday got together, had a baby, and did it on Super Bowl Sunday. I mean, it's that big a deal. And yes, the Chinese economy is certainly slowing down, but from a pretty quick pace. So I looked this up. Chinese online sales of goods up 16.8% over a year earlier. Now, that sounds great, and certainly it's better than overall consumer spending, but even that pace of a 16.8% increase in online sales is down by from 30%, which they saw in recent years. So certainly the pace is slowing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to ask you about another topic. Here in the United States, folks are spending money, buying lots of stuff, but some big-name retailers are also struggling. For instance, Gap CEO Art Peck just stepped down last week. Gap was once an iconic brand. What's happening here?
And maybe it's the way you just framed that. It was once, and it is in the past. And man, that's a tough thing for a retailer to have to confront. Peck was a former consultant. He was tasked with turning around the company. He was named CEO in 2015. But profit down more than 20% since he took over. Sales over that period barely budged. If you look at the stock price, just look at the Gap this year. It's down 34%. And that is compared to an 8% increase in the S&P's retail sector and a 23% rise in the broader S&P 500 index.
Wow. So they'll have to make lots of changes. We're hearing about them spinning off Old Navy, and the company may look a lot different in the next few years, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I mean, they say they're moving forward with this spinoff, but analysts are now looking at these numbers and they're saying, wait a second, maybe this is not the best idea. There are some who are wondering, has Old Navy also peaked?
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
The nation is marking Veterans Day today, and according to the Department of Veterans Affairs, as many as 20% of the men and women who served in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. We spoke with two of those vets about their experiences with PTSD earlier this year. Fidel Gomez Torres served in the Navy and was deployed once to Afghanistan. Army veteran Isaiah James served in Iraq and Afghanistan, a total of three tours. After he came home, Isaiah was close to suicide because of his PTSD. Fidel said he started to struggle soon after he came home in 2011, but he was very reluctant to admit it.
I feel like there was such a stigma, and still is, around having PTSD. There is this idea of brokenness that you carry. And for me, I've always been high functioning. I've always been an overachiever. So I was very stubborn and I was very resistant. Nevertheless, I still saw the symptoms, and deep inside, whenever I allowed myself to be honest, I would tell myself, I keep on saying I'm okay, but I don't think that I am.
Both men made the difficult decision to seek mental health care, but that's just the first step toward getting better. I asked Isaiah if he feels he's gotten the help he needs from the VA.
100% without equivocation, yes.
Fidel?
I had a couple of hiccups. I think that the intentions are in the right place. But I also know that my VA has been limited. And because of that, I had to play around with my treatment at first, which made it difficult. You know, you want to go in there, you want consistency, you want something that feels good, but is going to be lasting. And that wasn't the case for me. You know, initially, I was recommended acupuncture, just kind of like trying to get my feet wet. And it was supposed to be every 2 weeks, but, you know, there weren't enough, especially, you know, acupuncturists available to see me every 2 weeks. So it wasn't a cadence that I could follow. So I kept on hearing back from the VA saying, your appointment has been canceled. We have to reschedule you. So it was a little difficult. Eventually, they got it, you know, right. But I can definitely say that the resources are not always there.
Do you think that there are people who come back from combat situations in these wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan who don't deal with PTSD? Or do you think everybody does to some degree? Isaiah, I'll start with you.
To some degree, I would say, yes, everybody does. They like Fidel said, they may not know what it is or they may not know how to quantify it, but there is no person that I know that can go into war. And most people, they only see war, you know, extemporaneously from the outside, but it's a whole different animal when you're actually there and in it. And you cannot see that as a human being. You cannot be put in those situations or be around that environment for a year at a time in the Army's case and not come back with some kind of PTSD.
Fidel, when you live your civilian life here in the United States, do you feel like Americans understand what you have gone through?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Do you ever talk about it with people?
Not really. I think it's a difficult conversation to have with civilians. I think that unless you've experienced it, you really have no points of reference. So, you know, I can tell someone, you know, this is what my experience was. And there is a distance and almost kind of like, oh, I don't know. I feel like sometimes people romanticize service and war stories in a way that makes it seem like, okay, this is great. You know, it's great. Well, you know, you went out and you served. Yeah, I don't regret going out and serving. This is my country. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that people realize what happens when you go. And I don't think that people realize what happens when you come back. And I don't think that enough conversations, honest conversations, are had about the toll and the cost of war, not just in lives that don't come back, but in lives that come back and are broken.
Isaiah, what do you think? When you relate with people who have not served in this country, do you think that they have any sense of what you've been through?
Absolutely not. I don't really talk to people who haven't served about my experiences. I don't really let people know too often that I was even in the service. Like I said before, my lovely wife, I've opened up to her about some of my experiences, but as Fidel said, there's no point of reference. You know, I mean, some of the things that I've seen and done, there's no point of reference that I could tell you about seeing people actually blown into pieces. There's no point of reference that I could, you know, tell people about having at 18 years old to make a decision to take a human life or have your life be taken and be put in that position, have to do it day in and day out and day in and day out. It changes you. So there's no way I think I could get people who haven't served to actually understand. They may understand on the surface, like Fidel said, romanticize it and think about, you know, service is this great thing, but they don't understand the human toll that it takes on you just being in war.
What would each of you say to the government in Washington about what the military needs right now or what veterans need right now if they're listening? Fidel.
I don't think that the military needs much. We often take pride in having the best military or the greatest military, the mightiest military. We can't be mighty and also be insufficient. You have to pick one. I think that the greatest need is in how America treats its veterans when they come back. I walk down Newbury Street here in Boston, and you see homeless people holding up signs saying that they served in this war and they served in that war. There should be no person that serves this country, puts their life on the line, and is out holding a sign or cardboard, you know, in the streets, you know, without a home, without food. That should never be the case.
Isaiah?
I think that and a $20 trillion economy is such as ours, I think it's my duty as a veteran to say that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. As not only do veterans need more resources, but we can give those resources to all people in the country in need. I would say that Congress needs to have an honest conversation about where we allocate those resources. Because right now we're spending 10 times more on defense than we are education. So we're prioritizing war and warmongering more so than we're prioritizing education and educating the next generation. And I think Congress needs to have that honest conversation. We cannot be at war with the world. All great empires have fallen, the Romans, the Greeks, the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. We're stretching ourselves too thin. And I see us going down a path that if which we do not correct ourselves, we'll have disastrous consequences. So I think we need to get our house in order, pull some of those funds back from an overbloated military budget, and spend them on people at home.
Okay, I want to ask each of you one final question, which is, what would you say to veterans who may be listening to this who have not taken the steps to get help that both of you have, Fidel?
I would say be honest with yourself. You know, you don't have to be a hero. You don't have to project that you are okay if you're not. Be honest with yourself and stop being stubborn and refusing help. It's okay to need help. It's okay to get the help. It's amazing to heal. And I think that the moment that, you know, people start having honest conversations with what they can and cannot do, what they need and, you know, and the help that they, you know, want, there will be one step closer to healing.
Isaiah?
I would say to all my brothers and sisters who have served, you're not in this fight alone. I know it may seem like it at times, but there are truly people out there who care and want to help you. And there are people out there who have gone through the same experiences that you have. So please, we're losing too many of our brothers and sisters every day to suicide. Get the help that you need. The resources are there. You might have to go through some bureaucratic red tape, but do not choose a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
That is Army veteran Isaiah James and Navy veteran Fidel Gomez-Torres speaking with us about their service and also PTSD. Thanks to both of you. I'm so glad that both of you are getting the help that you need and that you talked about it with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court hears arguments tomorrow on the Trump administration's 2017 decision to end DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, an Obama-era program that allowed young immigrants brought to America as children, sometimes called dreamers, to avoid deportation. A decision on DACA could come as soon as next summer, right in the middle of the presidential campaign. Amy Howe is founder and reporter of SCOTUS Blog. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
So the justices are looking at three cases out of California, D.C., and New York, all challenging the administration's ending of DACA. What legal arguments are the plaintiffs making?
So there are two issues that the Supreme Court is going to consider. And the first one is whether or not the justices and courts in general can review the Trump administration's decision to terminate DACA at all. The Trump administration argues that this was a decision that it had discretion to take and that those are precisely the kind of discretionary decisions that courts have to stay out of. And then the second question is, if courts do have the power to review the Trump administration's decision to terminate DACA, was it a lawful decision?
About 700,000 so-called dreamers, as we call them, have been shielded from deportation under DACA. You talked a little bit about the Trump administration's argument, but can you go deeper on their argument on why this program should end?
Sure. So the Trump administration decided to end DACA. And what this case really boils down to, it's not so much about the substance as it is the process. There's mm-hmm. not really a lot of argument at the Supreme Court or elsewhere that the Trump administration couldn't decide to end DACA. The argument really is over how they went about doing it. The Trump administration announced in 2017 that it was going to terminate DACA, and then Secretary of Homeland Security Elaine Duke pointed to a one-page letter from Jeff Sessions, who was then the attorney general, who said, we believe that DACA is unconstitutional and illegal, and therefore we're going to terminate it, without saying that much more. And under something called the Administrative Procedure Act, a federal agency has to explain why it's doing something.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you correctly, the president has the legal authority to end DACA, but it's the justification that the administration has used that is at question.
Exactly, exactly. And there are a lot of parallels to the census case in which the Supreme Court heard oral argument last year. And what the Supreme Court decided was that the Trump administration could include a question about citizenship on the 2020 census, but they really went about it the wrong way. And by a 5-4 vote, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, joined the court's more liberal justices in saying that the rationale that you're providing doesn't match up for what the record actually looks like. And so the challengers are really trying to fit this case into that same mold.
A lot of us remember when the president said right after he took office that DACA recipients could, quote, rest easy. And he wanted to, quote, allow the dreamers to stay. How do his original statements complicate, if at all, these three cases?
Yeah, it is an interesting question. I think that the Supreme Court has really struggled with what do you do with the president's statements. Those were certainly an issue that was on display during the travel ban, less so in the census case. But I do think even more broadly, those statements were part of what brought this case to the Supreme Court. It really put the Department of Homeland Security into a box because the president may not have wanted to deal politically with terminating DACA. And so they really wanted to put the impetus on Congress and the courts. It wasn't us that terminated it. It's Congress and the courts who are at fault for terminating DACA.
So with that, if the court decides against the Trump administration, could the administration just end DACA again and give a different justification?
That's kind of the $64,000 question. I mean, everyone was watching to figure out what happened after the census case. You know, the Supreme Court, even after ruling against the Trump administration in the census case, didn't necessarily end the census case. They sent the case back for the Department of Commerce, perhaps to provide a better explanation. And in that scenario, the Trump administration simply ran out of time because they needed to go ahead and print the census. And there's not a timeline that's
on this
going to be limiting the Trump administration here. And so we could have a scenario in which the Trump administration did lose in the Supreme Court, and the Trump administration then did go ahead and end DACA. I mean, we're also dealing with the election. And so then the question becomes, if the Trump administration were to lose in the Supreme Court, would in an election year, you know, in the summer of 2020, would the Trump administration want to go ahead and end DACA? It could become a political rather than a legal issue, obviously.
Amy Howe, founder and reporter of SCOTUS Blog, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.